Greetings from the Southern Cohort of the 2019 UC Coro System-Wide Leadership Collaborative. Our cohort project is entitled Best Practices for Leading Campus and System-Wide Change Projects, and our deliverables include the production of podcast interviews with influential people in the area of change management, theory, and application. My name is Terry Winbush, the Senior Director of Labor Relations and Employee Relations for the UC San Diego campus. Our guest in this podcast is Patty Mason, CEO of UC San Diego Health. Joining me are two UC Coro Southern Cohort colleagues, Brandon Rhodes and Colin Demick.
Hi, I'm Patty Mason. I'm the CEO of UC San Diego Health.
I'm Colin Demick. I'm the Assistant Vice Chancellor of Environment, Health, and Safety at UCLA.
I'm Brandon Rhodes. I'm Chief of Staff to the Vice Chancellor of Health Sciences at UC San Diego.
Please tell us a little about your background and experience with change management.
I've been involved in C-suite level management of hospitals for 30 some years, primarily in Southern California. And in my tenure in those roles, I've been in a position to need to drive substantial change. As the industry's changed, internal change, culture change, policy change, processes change. So, I've been fortunate to be able to be exposed and to lead changes across multiple organizations.
So what does the phrase people side of change management mean to you?
This is a really important concept about change management. The bottom line is you can't lead change if you don't have the affected people involved in the process and buying into where you're going and agreeing with your problem statement and, agreeing that they want to help fix it. And if you don't have that, you can't drive change.
Could you tell me what your view, like problem statement, could you explain that a little bit?
Sure. I think a lot of times it's a really simple tool that you can do in change management before you do anything is to say, and be really crisp and really clear about this, what problem are we trying to solve? And do we have agreement that that is in fact the problem, right? So I think it's a really important starting point. If you don't have agreement on the problem, you're not going to have agreement on what kind of change, and solution you're going to try to drive.
One thing that we just got recognized for was our quality. So we moved from really low to 6th in the country. Can you talk a little bit about what kind of changes occurred to allow that to happen and how you manage that?
That was a really exciting change. In academic healthcare, we're all part of an organization called Vizient, and they rank us for quality and safety. And we had slipped to about 55th 2 years ago, and we had restructured our leadership. You have to have the right leaders in place to drive the change, right? And then we decided as a team, we were going to lay down the gauntlet. We were going to say, you know what? We're going to be top 10. We don't want to be 55th. We're embarrassed by 55th. We know we're better than that. And everybody, feels that strongly about it. And then, so we said, we're going to be top 10. Now, I expected that to happen in 3 to 5 years. And it actually happened in 2. And I think part of it was having the right team, having the right data, but probably most importantly, having the right focus, something, a goal that everybody could align around. Yeah, we want to be top 10. So it moved a lot faster. So I think that helps kind of bring that level of focus to achieve the change that needs to be achieved.
Yeah, the making it more realistic, tangible, something specific to head towards gets more buy-in.
Yeah, and it can be aspirational. Someone could have told us 2 years ago, there's no way you're going to get to top 10 in Vizient. And someone could look today and go, there's no way your faculty are going to be that engaged, But I think you have to set the aspiration and then get everyone focused to get there. And then you can get really specific. Okay, what are the, for the Vizient, what were the 3 things that we needed to fix to move from 55th to 6? It was, infection rates, it was safety, and it was patient centeredness. So then you can get really specific on how to fix those things. So I think it just is easier for people to wrap their heads around much more tangible, goals and tactics.
When you get a group bought in, and a big group, the change happens, as you said earlier, it's faster. It works better when everybody's behind.
It feels slower, but it actually works faster.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's slower on the front end, right? But it gets faster.
That's one of my favorite things in recent history.
That yeah.
done here.
I mean, that's just a huge win to do that much in such a short time.
So and build on that momentum because now people know you can do it.
Right.
Now you have change credibility.
Right.
My colleague Colin turned the conversation to strategic planning versus change management.
Going back to when you talk about the clear problem statements and the goal statements, which I love, that sounds like kind of standard strategic planning in a way. Is that the same as change management? Is there a line that pushes that over into change management? What is the same and different about those two things?
That's a good question. And they're definitely interconnected. You know, I think, again, change can be driven from external threats or internal issues. And that would be separate from the strategic goals of the organization. But ultimately, even if you align around the strategic goals, it requires a lot of change to actually implement them. So that's where they kind of intersect again. I don't know how you actually do implement strategic planning without driving change. They kind of go hand in hand.
But that seems to drive for integrated change management skills as just part of your management infrastructure because you're always engaging in change management at some level. And then we look at some of these ideas of bringing in specialists in change management, maybe that would be for certain special projects that require that kind of a push. Does that sound right?
Yes, I've done it both ways. When I first started here in 2012, I think, you know, we had 22 days cash on hand. So that was a huge threat, you know, where we were financially at the time. And we knew that we had to, you know, drive a lot of change very quickly. We were new to the organization. We knew we were going to have to do a layoff. We knew we were going to have to do a lot of things. And we knew we wanted to stick around. So, you know, a lot of times when you have to drive change, if it's hard, you know, it's better sometimes to use an external group to help you do that. And then everyone can be upset with them and they can leave.
Exactly right.
But so it depends on what you're doing. So sometimes it's really handy, you know, to use like an external consulting group or a domain expert to either help you with that part of it, just the extra bandwidth that can help you put all the, you know, all the data together that you need to drive the change. But ultimately, it really is hard to move the organization without the leaders owning the change and really being the sponsors of that change.
And it sounds like change management needs to be part of every manager's toolkit.
Absolutely. It's actually a different, and I wouldn't have said this probably 5 years ago, but it requires a level of emotional intelligence and kind of emotional maturity even more. So then I know how to analyze data and I know how to implement change based on, I know lean. You can know those things, you can know those techniques, you can have those strategies, but it's really kind of understanding your audience, so to speak, or the stakeholders to the change. And if someone doesn't have that, they could be the best analyst, the best process improvement, the best planner, you know, you could possibly have. But if they can't stay with the kind of the hearts and minds of the stakeholders, then again, they aren't going to be successful. So I think we do have to look for leaders. We either have to train them up to do that or we have to hire them to have that skill set, especially in our industry right now.
What do you see as advantages and disadvantages of a centralized change management office, either at the location level or at the office of the president level?
Right. I think that there's a lot of techniques and there are specific process improvement techniques that are really beneficial when you're trying to move a whole culture. So, and for things like that, I think it's really helpful to have an office like our transformational healthcare team, because they're trainers, they're coaches, they're mentors. They're there to help back to training up for change management skills. They're helping do that. So I think there's a real role for them in terms of that, you know, helping us stand up an organization of not 20 change managers, but 9,000 change managers, you know, who understand that every day they come to work, they need to be thinking about the patient and how best to meet the need. And if they see an opportunity to drive a change that will improve either the operation or the care to the patient, that they should take it and do it. So I think those offices can be really helpful.
What is the most important aspect of communication during the change process?
The most important communication is clarity on the problem, clarity on what's going to change, and then driving it out across whatever portfolio needs to be involved in the change. And I think And I actually learned this from our chancellor. In some ways, it's retail politics. You have to be down at every single person's level. Everybody has to understand. And you would hope that it would cascade down, but it doesn't. So you have to think ahead of, okay, well, then how are we going to make sure things cascade down? And how are we going to share the messages? And, you know, what are the right tools to drive it out? And I think we're only beginning to kind of learn how to use some of the kind of the social media techniques to drive out information. Because I think that's where we're going.
My colleague Brandon changed the topic to dealing with resistance.
Every change tends to have its resistance and its resistors. What strategies do you use when you run into that resistance to either help them assimilate the change or bring them on board to what you're trying to accomplish?
It's a little bit of art. This isn't a science, because you always are going to have resistors. And the question is, how much do you stop and try to engage them and bring them in? Or how much do you just keep moving down? You know, do you have enough of the hearts and minds that you're going to be fine, even if you have that small contingent of detractors or dissenters? And you're always going to have that. So I think that's the part that's tricky, is making that judgment. And sometimes you don't know, except that when you're in the process and then you know there's dissent and you keep moving and it gets louder and stronger rather than the reverse, then I would say that's when you have to take a step back and go, okay, what are we missing here? What are we doing wrong? Or what can we do to be better aligned? And it's going to take us an extra couple months to get to where we need to go, because we have to take this step back and figure it out. But if you don't, it's just going to get, you know, louder and louder and louder. That's the art and science of it. And you make mistakes, so you have to learn.
You talked about sometimes bringing external people, sometimes having your own dedicated group, or just training the trainer methodology. How do you determine what kind of resources you need for a particular change? Is that a decision you kind of make with your team, or is that something you socialize a little bit to see what the response rate is?
Number one is understanding the size of the project and the scope of the change and what it's going to take. And then kind of an assessment of the internal resources and what's it going to take and what do we have. If you do engage an outside firm to help you, you have to make sure that the internal people are both in a position to provide all they need to provide for the project to work, and also to manage the consultants. If anyone thinks they don't need to manage external consultants, yeah, you have to manage them. You kind of have to assess both your internal resources as well as what you're going to bring from the outside.
What are the viable strategies for a campus or the system as a whole to manage multiple changes? I feel like you have a lot of experience in this regard, particularly because of the way health systems work.
I think number one, the senior leadership has to be aligned around it and central coordinating oversight of those changes. But I think it's important to make sure that things are spread out enough so that you're not putting too much into one group of people. We can drive a lot of change. Like HR can be doing this change, and nursing can be doing this change, and supply chain can be doing their change. And, you know, they all have bandwidth to do their own. They couldn't do it all, but they can do their own. And we just have to make sure that we have that visibility as kind of executive sponsors of that change, that we can kind of track it and follow it. I'm a huge believer in setting up a project management office for any big change. So that means you have executive sponsors, you have oversight, you have a cadence for the work, which is really important. You know, you have work streams and they have deliverables and they're coming back and talking to the steering committee. You know, there's just a pace to it. That's the other thing, is like, you can let things peter out, right? So if you're going to do it, really do it, and then set up that discipline of, I'm coming back every month and I'm telling them what I'm done to drive that change. And then you can kind of manage it better. It is really good to get those, a little bit of wind behind your sails, like some quick wins, you know, early is really helpful. And sometimes when you're doing it, like, people go for the hardest problem. This is the most festering, hardest problem, and we got to solve that. And sometimes, like, you're better off picking off something to get some momentum and to gain some credibility and to get some wind under your sails in terms of, so yeah, go for the low-hanging fruit.
Can you talk a little bit about the rapid process improvement and the transformational health changes that you implemented here? I've been to a few of those report outs, and I think it really goes along with this, because it's multiple groups all reporting on how they've changed something in the organization.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about those?
Sure. I mean, I think the rapid process improvement, what we do basically, again, identified the problem, what team of people is going to fix it. I really like the projects that are multidisciplinary, that have faculty and staff and EVS and whoever else touches that problem involved in it. And then you utilize lean tools to kind of identify obstacles and potential fixes and potential outcomes, and you identify every obstacle. You can look at one simple process and we can have like 10 wrong turns in the middle of this, but nobody steps back long enough to figure out, oh, wow, that's a really inefficient way to do this. All right, what if we took this out and this out and this out? And what if we made the path of travel this way? And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you've leaned out and you've made those processes work a lot better. So it's really energizing for anyone who's involved with one. And then they get to live it. They can come to work every day and go, wow, I fixed that process. Okay, now what am I going to do next? So it's really empowering. That's probably the thing I like about it the most, is it really empowers people to drive change. Sometimes I have a little bit of a, I won't say disagreement, but difference of opinion. I think if we're going to go through the time and effort to do rapid process improvement, which is a week-long commitment of a bunch of people to drive a specific change, that change should be big enough to move the needle. And sometimes, so you really need to have a lot of judgment around what you're problem solving for.
So you talked about the rapid change initiatives you're using as part of lean management, et cetera. I'm curious what method you guys have adopted there.
So I have a very passionate point of view around this. And that is, I don't have the religion of lean. I don't have the religion of Six Sigma. I don't have the religion of Gemba. I have the religion of process improvement, the UCSD way. And we define what UCSD way is, meaning there are going to be certain circumstances where it's right to do Gemba. There's going to be others where it's right to do DES, or it's right to do a rapid process improvement. I just want all the tools in my arsenal. And then depending on what I'm trying to do, I want the culture to be that at UC San Diego Health, we're trying to drive for the best processes, the most highly reliable organization we can develop. And I'm a bit agnostic to, I'm just going to do it the lean way, or I'm just going to do the Virginia Mason way. It's funny though that you asked that question, because we've had a lot of executive team, not arguments, but disagreements about this. Because if someone came from Virginia Mason, that's what they think is the right way. And someone came from this organization, I think this is the right way. And so everyone kind of buys into the kind of the little bit of the religion around it. And I'm like, no, like, we're not going to do that. I don't want to implement the Stanford way. I don't want to implement the UCLA way, no offense. I want to implement the UC San Diego way. And, you know, it's going to be right tool for right problem at the right time.
How were you trained on change management? Meaning, did you learn the Virginia Mason way, or were you trained in the ProSci way? Have you been trained in all of them? And so that's why you have this internal arsenal.
So when I got my MBA from UCLA, no, they didn't teach this stuff at all. So, you know, I've had to pick it up more organically. Sometimes I've learned it from external consultants. Sometimes I've learned it from, you know, my own team. I learn a lot from my own team, the folks that we have on our executive team that have come from different organizations. I'm like, wow, that's a really good way to do it. So I'm just trying to be a sponge for all the different ways. And then again, you know, have really smart people with and around me that have some experience, and we kind of come to some understanding of how we're going to do it. We are moving pretty specifically to having a very, you know, very set daily engagement system throughout the organization. You know, the nursing profession has moved to what they call this magnet journey. And so that has its own set of things too, right? So we want to do daily engagement. They're doing magnet. So how do we, again, put this in our language for our culture and make it work? And I think, again, you have to be flexible to learn it all and then figure out, you know, how you want to bundle it together to be, for us, the UC San Diego way. And again, I'll tell you my bottom line on this. You can do drive transformation all day long. If you don't have a way to account for the improvements, measure it, and keep it integrated, you know, it doesn't stick. When I first came here and when the days cashed were 22, we did a big overtime effort, and we tried to get everybody to, you know, learn how to manage overtime and created a system for it. And then come back 3 years later and everybody's back to their old habits again. And like, how did that happen? Why didn't that stick? And it's because we weren't laser focused on measuring it in perpetuity. So again, I get in these discussions about whatever it is, lean, and if it's not being measured and sustained in the culture, it will go away no matter what. And things will return to the way they used to be. So it's hardwiring things and then having the right dashboards in place, I think, to measure it.
So what methods do you use to track the changes you're engaged in?
I mean, what we try to do is develop as much as possible using existing systems, you know, creating dashboards that give us a sense of where we are in terms of what we were trying to achieve. That can also get out of hand, you know, where you've got, you know, 2,000 custom dashboards that nobody's looking at. I think you have to, again, be disciplined about what's important and what you're measuring and then creating the dashboards to support that, but not get so sucked into the minutia of analytics that, you know, everybody's creating their own dashboards and what's the single source of truth and, you know, all those kinds of conversations that can come up.
Do you have a way of measuring the potential for a proposed change to bring about improvements? Can you run performance models in advance?
I think you need to. I mean, again, I think it's really important to know where you're at, to either do it on the front end of your effort. We'll really do it there. Or sometimes it's the metrics itself that's driving the change. So if we know if I'm at 22 days cash on hand, I need to be at 60, you know, that's a pretty specific measure. And then, you know, all the tactics underneath to get there can be measured against, you know, where you're trying to get to. You can make those kinds of those judgment calls along the way. Have I gotten far enough or not? Is it worth the extra, whatever effort it's going to take to get the last 10% or not, or 2%? I think everybody has to be nimble enough to make those calls. Sometimes it's not worth it. Like sometimes you learn as you go through it that the cost is so high that you need to rethink your goal.
You talked about sometimes things not going well. Are there signals that a proposed change should be reconsidered or even possibly terminated?
Yes. I mean, I think there's kind of the data parts of it that could potentially give you that clue. But I also think it's the growth of the resistance that can be a really big clue that you've got a problem and you're going to need to rethink.
And is there a way you go about pulling the plug if that resistance has gotten too big?
Sometimes it takes a restructuring of the leadership. You know, sometimes it takes, honestly, pulling people out, putting different people in. Again, you need to have all those potential moves, you know, available to you if you're finding yourself out of alignment with, you know, your constituents.
Well, and sometimes even if you're not changing what you're trying to do, an individual is identified by that growing resistance and that there's just no way to move without at least changing that name.
Right. Exactly right.
So in a more general sense, what would you say are the most important characteristics for senior leaders that they should show when introducing and managing change initiatives?
Clarity of purpose. Back to, do we all agree on what the problem is? Ability to create the burning platform and communicate the burning platform. You know, ability to develop the structure that it's going to take to drive the change. And then that emotional intelligence, that communication, that hand-holding that inevitably will come up, even your senior leaders, you need to hand-hold through. I guess the last thing would be just an optimism that you're doing the right thing. And again, it doesn't have to be perfect. We just have to move from where we are. And we always have the opportunity to pivot and course correct. And that's okay.
The music in this podcast is entitled The Fifth Life by Circus Marcus.